There is nothing wrong with your television set. Do not attempt to adjust the picture. We are controlling transmission. We will control the horizontal. We will control the vertical. We can change the focus to a soft blur or sharpen it to crystal clarity. For the next hour, sit quietly and we will control all that you see and hear. You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to...
Welcome to What a Week, and as ever, what a week it's been. Good news, folks, or bad news, depending on your appetite for derangement. We're not going to get too deep into politics this week. Today is a all-entertainment version of What a Week, because we're joined by Brian Lowry, not just a TV critic, a cultural critic, a man with 35 years of experience covering the wonderful world of TV and now movies. Brian's written for Variety, the LA Times, CNN, The Wrap, and now the much coveted Status. And I have a question. Brian, are you there? Brian Lowry, Earth to Brian. Well, we'll get him on as we come out, but join us again. What a Week will be off and running in just a few seconds. Brian, are you there?
I am here.
There we are. Yeah, it's just once on this show. I'm going to do that snazzy open, and the tech will sort itself out. Well, welcome. This is a long time coming, Brian. It's safe to say you and I go a ways back.
We go farther back than you care to admit.
Yes, I think I got a hold of you the first time because I actually loved a very negative review you'd written about something I'd produced. I reached out to say, yep, it's a fair cop. This was one of the most horrific things in the history of television. You aptly nailed me on it. And from
was
there,
was it when Chefs Attack?
Yes, but I do recall, if unless I'm mistaken, you said, and I think I'm quoting semi-accurately, it was the greatest single thing in the history of television or something, but I have a hunch your tongue was very firmly in cheek.
But there's nothing quite like Fox in the 1990s. That was truly an epic era of craptastic television.
Craptastic is exactly the right word for it. Well, I briefly talked about your credits, but the thing that really stands out to me, Brian, is that you're a survivor. You were writing for the LA Times when they were, what was it, print, where they actually delivered things to your door back in that day. And then you went over to Variety, and that's where every executive in town got a copy of Variety mailed every day. I was one of those executives and reading your stuff. Then you went over to CNN. Then you went over to The Wrap, and now you're at Status, which I mean it very non-facetiously, is one of the hippest and best newsletters going. And I subscribed even before you came on just because I loved what Oliver was doing at CNN. And now you're pretty much covering everything. And as now television has become politics and politics has become television and all of it is professional wrestling, you're really your man at the center of things. So...
Well, yeah. I mean, it's funny. I said, if you're working in journalism the last few years, I always, and this dates me, you know, when I make these references, if I make them to younger colleagues, they look at me blankly. But I feel like Slim Pickens holding on to the bomb at the end of Dr. Strangelove. You know, which is you're going down and you're going to blow up. It's just a question of how long you can hang on before the explosion. CNN, my stint at CNN was really a perfect example of what's happening, because I got hired when they were kind of flush and investing and covering media. And, you know, by the time I left CNN, it was, you know, they were kind of looking around going like, why are these people here? And I think that's what a lot of us are dealing with.
Well, I won't call him the Grim Reaper. I'll call him the Grin Reaper, because David Zaslav always has that sort of chiclet-toothed evil smile on his soulless face. But we both were intertwined with David Zaslav. When I worked at the Discovery Channel, Zaslav kind of oozed his way into it in the, I think around 2007, and basically destroyed it. He followed the Neutron Jack Welch playbook, stripped out any of its functioning parts, and all of its... Like, I remember in 2001 when they deactivate HAL and they sort of take all of his higher brain functions away. Well, that's what he did to Discovery. And then, not to my surprise, because I had this guy down, I sort of knew there were no limits. He, of course, wangled the buyout of Warner Brothers and proceeded then to do the same magic on CNN. Briefly tried to get away with destroying Turner Classic Movies, which was a really brilliant move on his part, and had to put that back because a lot of people objected quite strenuously. And then CNN has, I won't say been on life support, but I think he's been distracted. I think had he not decided to sell it for parts and was implementing that plan, I think he probably would have been doing a lot of very horrific things under the hood at CNN, but I think he's been distracted. But why don't we talk about topic A, and that is what's been going on with – it's one big story, and it's the big story, I think, of our world today is what's happened to Paramount, Barry Weiss taking over CBS News, now – the hemorrhoid-lipped fail son, David Ellison, is on a world tour now to try to garner support as a hostile bid, where Paramount and his equally evil dad, Larry Ellison, is going to try to throw money and take over Warner Brothers and then pull the plug on CNN or put Barry Weiss in charge of that. A lot going on here, and Trump is behind all of it. So this is my incredibly biased thing, and I want viewers, listeners to know that disclaimer means that everything I'm saying, Brian Lowry does not, repeat, not share any of my opinions. So I want to push him away because I don't want him to be contaminated by my very fervent beliefs here. But you actually...
I may share a few, but it's... Go ahead.
No, but... your take on this, I mean, what's, you know, right up to the date now, do you think, again, to make it simple, folks, if Netflix gets Warner Brothers, they'll get HBO. Sarandos is, of course, a soulless, evil corporate hack, but he's not a super evil, super villain corporate hack like the Ellisons. So us liberals are saying, well, the evil of two lessers or the lesser of two evils would be Netflix. But Paramount is not going down without a fight, and they've got Trump in the corner. So what do you see happening here? Where does this go?
Yeah, I don't, you know, I honestly don't know what the resolution of all this is going to be. I know John Oliver said something the other day, which I thought was right, which is that mergers are always bad for people who work at the companies, and his hope was just... that whatever the result was would be the least bad option.
Which is bring on Netflix then, basically.
Which, you know, it's very hard. I mean, a lot of people in Hollywood understandably are concerned about Netflix. They're concerned they're going to blow up the theatrical movie window. My take on it is generally that Netflix... that either of these things are bad, that either of these things are going to result in a lot of people losing their jobs, and consolidation and concentration of voices and all those things. But just based on Paramount's behavior since it started chasing, since the guys at Skydance started chasing Paramount, acquired Paramount, and then immediately set their sights on Warner Brothers.
And Skydance would be David Ellison's company.
David Ellison's company.
Dad-funded company.
It feels to me like they're the worst option. Well, and worse for a couple of reasons. One is that they've shown, as you said, a real willingness to play ball, whether they believe it or not, or whether they're just being opportunists. They've shown a real willingness to play ball with Trump and try to sort of cozy up to him to get what they want corporately. And also because if you lay Paramount on top of Warner Brothers, or really Warner Brothers on top of Paramount, because it's the bigger company, the overlap is so direct that it is going to just result in thousands and thousands of people losing their jobs. And Netflix is not, I mean, they're in the same business, obviously, but what they do is a bit more complementary in that respect. I don't think, I may be naive, but I don't think immediately anyways that the Netflix guys are going to destroy the theatrical distribution business because they spent too much. I mean, if they pay $82 billion or $83 billion for this company, they need to get that money back. And, you know, Superman and Batman movies are not going to make as much just going straight to Netflix as they'll make if you plop them in theaters where they can earn several hundred million dollars. So those lines may cross eventually. And I'm sure, you know, I don't have any illusions that Netflix doesn't want to do what's best for Netflix. But practically speaking, I don't see how it makes sense for Netflix to pay a fortune to acquire Warner Brothers and then to immediately destroy the movie business.
Well, if you look at what David Ellison or the Ellisons did with CBS News, they promoted the grossly underqualified Barry Weiss, who is basically a professional conservative victim. Her whole thing was, I'm victimized because of my beliefs in free speech, which is why I'm now quitting the New York Times. Then I'm going to go into business with billionaires to start my own university. Then I'm going to be funded by wealthy billionaires to start the Free Press. And then I'm going to sell my company for $150 million to David Ellison and take over CBS News. So she's quite the victim, and she has no voice here, does she? And the moment they she was right in the door, and that's when they spiked the 60-minute story on CECOT, the El Salvadorian prison, which will obviously never air. They've got Tony DeCoppel in, who amazing bit of word salad as he's trying to demonstrate how he's. We're just going to go to the ordinary American, vox populi. America knows best. I mean, he's trying to do Lonesome Roads here, Brian, but not doing very well. And, well, there's an illuminating thing just last week at the same Detroit Ford plant where Trump was, well, we'll get to that in a second. DeCoppel did a great, he got the man himself. So this is an excerpt from that interview.
I inherited a mess of crime. I inherited a mess of inflation. I inherited a mess of places closing up and going to other countries. And now we have the hottest country in the world. Tony, we have now the hottest country in the world. And a year and a half ago, our country was dead. We had a dead country. You wouldn't have a job right now. If she got in, you probably wouldn't have a job right now.
That's what we cynics call a tell. If she had gotten in, you wouldn't have had your job. So I would take that to mean that Trump is well aware that Barry Weiss wouldn't have her job, a.k.a. DeCoppel. Though I have to admit, weren't you looking forward to Whiskey Fridays? So in case you don't follow news as obsessively as Brian and I do, there was a accidental release of a set, a diagram for a set, where DeCoppel was going to have Whiskey Fridays sponsored by Jack Daniels, where we didn't know quite what it was, but it sounded absolutely compellingly horrific, like, you know, the world's greatest, you know, bus wreck. And then I think the mass revulsion spiked it. But
I think, you know what, I think that's more emblematic of a larger, you know, issue, which is that as linear television sort of breathes its what look like its prolonged death throes, you're going to see all kinds of things that will just make you either groan or scratch your head or wince or whatever. I mean, if you watch the Golden Globes, and a lot of people did not, but, you know, there are always several million people that do, they incorporated, you know, betting market predictions into the show as part of a sponsorship tie-in with Polymarket. And it's just emblematic of, you know, we're going to wring every dollar we can out of these things, even if it means cheapening the franchise.
Well, the question,
and I think, you know, CBS News is never been, look, you know, the news divisions were not pristine before Barry Weiss got there. But she clearly has come in with a mandate and a belief that they need to be shaken up. And I think it's going to be, incredibly uncomfortable for the people at CBS.
It already is. They announced earlier in the week they won't run the CECOT El Salvador story, but they did put out a CBS exclusive that the Jonathan Ross, the guy who fired three shots at point blank range at the side of an innocent civilian, was hospitalized with internal injuries. What was their source? The Trump administration. And these are the same people who spiked the CBS, the 60 Minutes story, because it didn't have enough sourcing. And that's been pushed back because Ross didn't spend a day in the hospital. He went.
I mean, the interesting part about this to me is that, and I've seen it over and over again, and I saw it at CNN, is that there is this sort of faulty logic that arises in different places from time to time, that if so-called bastions of mainstream media, you know, noted for being liberal or accused of being liberal or leaning left or left of center or whatever you want to call them, that if they just pander enough to the right, that they'll bring in a bunch of viewers who weren't watching them before. And, you know, the experience I've seen with this time and again is that those people do not want to watch you. They're for the most part lost to you. You can't do enough to mollify them. And all you're going to do is end up alienating the audience you have, or not all of it, but chunks of it. And, you know, the question is, I guess, and I don't know how to do this calculus, and I think the people at Paramount are probably doing it somewhere, is what benefits do we get from that that can offset what we're going to lose in terms of audience and prestige.
I'll
at
tell
CBS
you, they
News.
Get they get to Trump to put his thumb on the scale, so they can do a hostile bid and take over Warner Brothers. And
they do, but you know that won't necessarily be enough by itself. I mean, his is obviously a very loud voice, but it won't be the only voice. You know, there'll be the European Union and other regulators and state attorneys general, and you know, he isn't the only person. So if the thought is that we can get enough benefits from Trump to make all of this worthwhile and all of the sacrifices we could potentially make in terms of something like 60 Minutes, which has been a money machine, you know, for the network over the years. I think it's, you know, I understand that logic. I think it's really questionable.
Well, 60 Minutes, I think, is done. I mean, if every single editorial decision is going across Barry Weiss's desk, and she's spiking stories right and left, I don't know how long the people working there can put up with it. They're leaking like sieves right now, so every misstep is being reported and amplified. So, I mean, there's two ways to do it, to think that the hemorrhoid-lipped fail son, David Ellison, is doing this out of a great desire to open up, quote, free speech, unquote, and reach the ordinary American for a programming and or ideological reason, or if it's just to kiss up to Trump, because that's what Dad wants, and ultimately they want it all. I'm going to probably go for door number two here, Brian. I don't think these are super geniuses with Machiavellian-like strategies, and they're dealing with as I refer to him, the senile Satan, someone with the cranial capacity of a toddler now, throwing feces against the wall every chance he gets, decision making and reversing himself. So I really, as much as I'd like to think that these people are the steely-eyed rocket men making smart decisions and baking it out, I just think it's very reactive.
Well, it is. And, you know, there's a long New York Magazine piece about David Ellison, which is pretty, it's too long, but it's pretty good. And it doesn't make him look, you know, whatever people have labeled him, like an ideologue in any way. So it does. I mean, what you come away from that with is a sense that they're doing this because they think it's to their advantage.
And he makes his bones with his dad. His sister flamed out. And, you know, just no one's talking about Megan, who was set up to run her studio, Annapurna, and had a very spectacular flame out. She just couldn't handle the pressure. She had some psychological issues, I think, of the poor thing that stopped her from, you know, and that whole thing just fell apart. And then I took away from the New York Magazine article, David is obsessively wanting to prove himself to Dad. And Dad is an absolute, utter sociopath in the Donald Trump adjustment, where he doesn't know what love is or relationships are. And David's trying to, which is a human thing. That's the one thing I can give David Ellison credit for. But didn't you get the sense that he just wants to show Dad that he's the Fredo of sons? He wants to prove that he can, I can do stuff. And this whole thing is him trying to get his wings after being a failed actor, after being a failed action movie producer. Now he's trying to do this just to prove himself.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very age-old story in Hollywood, and I've seen it, you know, having covered it for a long time. I went from, I always say I mark my years in Hollywood by the number of sons and daughters of people who worked in Hollywood that I end up interviewing, where I had interviewed their fathers or mothers, rarer so when you go back, years earlier. And, you know, it is a different thing when you grow up, you know, hungry versus when you come up with the silver spoon. That doesn't mean that all of these people are ill-equipped or incompetent. In some respects, they're very competent because, you know, they internalized a lot that they saw when they were growing up. They paid attention and they learned. But they just don't have the same, oftentimes the same drive and grit that you see in the generation that preceded them coming up into the business. And, you know, that profile was really illuminating in the sense that you're right, that he looked like someone who had known he could go try a bunch of different things and had a parachute, you know, no matter, or not so much parachute, but that there was a big soft landing pad. If he fell on his face, there was Dad and Dad's money there to prop him up.
Well, I wish I'd come up with this term, but when you were talking about the monetization of the Golden Globes and betting and just the whole mulch of the culture, the clicktatorship, I love that line, you know, the clicktators. You know, we're living under a clicktatorship right now where people's attention is the most valuable commodity, whether it be TikTok videos, YouTube, John Oliver, you know, whatever else is going on, that everyone is vying for a sliver of attention. And the one thing that the senile Satan has got is this preternatural ability to keep acquiring demanding attention. You know, everything, every day there's some new thing that forces us to have to listen to him or look at him. In that same interview with DeCoppel, I just want to have one more little bit here, if this doesn't chill you to the bone here.
Is there anything that limits your power, your movement, your action here other than your own morality?
Well, I talk about morality. I'm a moral person. I don't like seeing death. I don't like seeing our people hurt. I don't like seeing the other side hurt either. So, yeah, it's limited by my morality, and I have a very high grade of morality, so therefore it's limited.
Now, President, thank you very much. For the record, I do think I'd have this job even if the other guys won.
Yeah, but at a lesser salary. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
One guy, the man does understand how the world works. Now, he left this interview, and this is where a good bit of news here, folks. He walked out of there, and a plucky union worker yelled at him, screamed a pedophile protector. Now, most of us, what's the difference between most of us and Donald Trump? If we hear someone randomly scream pedophile protector, we don't automatically think they're talking about us. But Trump, of course, realized who they were talking about instantly because, wait a minute, of course he is one, and flipped him the New Jersey state bird and walked out, which of course was clawed under. But quite the thing. Well, I'd like to take a short musical break where we combobulate. And Brian Lowry, I would like to come back to talk about the Golden Globes. And I'd like to talk about, we're approaching award season. I want to really shift to entertainment. And I want to talk about the J. Penske Industrial Awards Complex. I think you know what I'm talking about, but I don't think listeners are quite aware of how the flora and fauna of award season and how it all interconnects and works. So stand by. You're listening to What a Week. I'm having an out-of-body experience here. I'm Eric Nelson. I'm here with Brian Lowry.
Within spirit.
And I'm playing play a couple songs that are about television, topic number A, that you may not have heard. This is a group called 21 Pilots from an album, I love the title, Mediocre at Best.
We don't believe what's on TV because it's what we want to see. And what we want, we know we can't believe. We've all learned to kill our dreams. I need to know that when I fail, you'll still be here. Oh, 'cause if you stick around, I'll sing you pretty sounds and we'll make money selling your hair. You are out of my mind. Oh, you aren't seeing my side. On your mind. I used to say I wanna die before I'm old, but because of you I might think twice. I don't care what's in your hair, I just wanna know what's on your mind. I used to say I wanna die before I'm old, but because of you I might think twice.
Well, we may not believe what's on TV, but we can't escape it. I'm here with Brian Lowry, veteran, I think that's the right word for you, Brian, veteran writer on all things television, now movies, and because television movies is politics, and it's all one big clicktatorship. You're the man at the center of everything right now. So congratulations, Brian.
Thank you. It feels like I should have won something bigger based on that. But no, you know, it was interesting. When I left CNN, I came up with this idea that there was this giant hole in writing about the center of politics and pop culture. And I kind of went around and pitched that a bunch of different places. And they all kind of went, huh? And then it feels like that's what everybody is covering and writing about now. So I think I was a few months ahead of my time on that. But that does seem to be where we're living right now.
Watching the cutting edge from behind. well, as we now approach award season, so I'll sketch this out in my jaundiced, rapid-paced way. And again, correct me if I'm wrong, but my way, just to give you listeners who aren't as dialed into the wonderful world of show biz as you and I, they're called the trades. So there was the Variety, which you, Brian Lowry, wrote for, the Hollywood Reporter, which was the traditional rival to Variety. There was Deadline. It started, speaking of cynical and jaundice, a writer named Nikki Fink started Deadline as an antidote to the trades and covering the real story when the massive Writers Guild strike, a couple of strikes back, which attained some purchase. There's IndieWire. There's Rolling Stone magazine. And there's the Golden Globes, which is the awards that just ran last week. And there's South by Southwest, which is one of the film festivals to premiere new and upcoming films and artists. Now, these things have one thing in common, Brian Lowry, he's asked rhetorically, and that would be?
Jay Penske.
Yes.
Who owns all of them.
Yes. You know those trucks with Jay Penske trucks you see, usually driven by people who've just learned to drive, not just drive trucks, but seemingly just learned to drive a motor vehicle. Anyway, speaking of Nepo babies, well, Jay Penske is the heir to that fortune. He owns all of this. So the way it works is, the economics of same is, what keeps Variety and IndieWire and a lot of these publications going, the trades afloat, is movie studios spend massive amounts of money on ads that are touting their product because they want to win awards. And you have the Golden Globes, which is the traditional harbinger of the awards, which everyone looks at to set the tone to who's going to win the big awards. That's owned by him, too. So he owns that. And then the films that go into South by Southwest, which often kind of bubble up, whether they're television or movies, they get the attention that starts the whole cycle. And we're on the eve of Sundance. It's the one thing that Penske doesn't own. But I won't say that it's a rigged game, but there is an economy and ecology about awards that I don't think people are aware of as they should be. So over to you, Brian. Is this something that people should be a little more attentive to? Is there a danger that one guy owns so much of, like, in essence, owns all of the Hollywood press right now?
Well, I think, yeah. I mean, I think there's been the Variety and the Reporter thing. I mean, you really have to understand the origins of that, because those two, you know, went at it like cats and dogs through most of their history. They were hugely competitive, and have all of these trades consolidated under the same umbrella is weird. It obviously, I think the intention was to make them, they operate in, you know, they're supposed to operate independently journalistically. And I know a lot of journalists over there still, and there are a lot of good people at those publications. But the idea was to beat people into submission so that, you know, if you're going to buy an ad saying, please consider our movie for an Oscar, they're the only game in town. And it hasn't, you know, it hasn't worked out as well as hoped, because the business isn't the business that it was. So what's happened, and, you know, in some respects, you're a victim of this, and then you can be a beneficiary, is that, you know, as people have gotten, I think, less trusting these sources a little bit less, you're seeing these sort of alternative, smaller sites cropping up. And that seems to be where a lot of the energy is in the space right now.
And that's, I mean, where Variety, you are with your status. I mean, yeah, there's Puck, there's, which is, you know, Baloney.
And status, and you know, and then on the political side, you're seeing things like Zateo and the Bulwark and these sites that have cropped up that are basically saying, you know, if you're sick of the New York Times, if you're sick of Variety, if you're sick of any of these sort of mainstream institutional journalistic outlets, we're going to come at it a little differently, and in, you know, in a lot of ways, I think in the eyes of a lot of people, a little more honestly, because there's pressures not to upset, either pressures to be even-handed in a way that comes to look ridiculous in certain issues, or pressures to to mollify people who are your advertisers or your sponsors or who you want to be in business with. So.
Well, I would think
people are very right to be skeptical of so much of anything being consolidated in a few hands, and that's, you know, that's the other big story of this time, is a media owned by a handful of people. It's gone through this over the years, but you know, when you have billionaire owners, what you discover pretty quickly is they have interests that are much bigger than the newspaper or TV network that they own.
Well, But when it comes to the, you know, the Oscars, the Golden Globes, the awards, the Emmys, that so much is concentrated that is this closed loop right now. The one area that I can speak to with some authority is the wonderful world of documentaries, feature documentaries and short documentaries, which used to be sort of the people's thing where weird things would win and people would always be looking at their watches when the presenters came up, you know, got their awards at the Oscars. But now, you know, you're not even going to get on the short list unless you spend $500,000 and Netflix or Hulu or Disney or Apple are pretty much subsidizing your run. It's impossible. You can't do it.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, it's interesting because that was another reason actually that someone said to me that Netflix is a preferable option for filmmakers, just because, you know, Netflix and HBO, which potentially if that merger goes through would be under the same parent company, but that those two outlets basically support, you know, a huge chunk of the documentary business. I mean, if you can't get your documentary picked up by Netflix or picked up by HBO, you know, your options dwindle dramatically.
Now tell me about it. Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, and you can really be screwed. So it's, you know, there are certain things that these companies do that they do, they're not doing it altruistically, but that they do well.
But don't you think, though, it's Sarandos and Zaslav. When he says this name, his lips curl with venom, that it's just an ego thing for Oscars. Does this really move people? Do people, certainly when you get an Oscar as a creative, as a director, as a filmmaker, it's your Willy Wonka e-ticket. You can get a lot more works. Actual creative people, I'm not sure it benefits the box office, and I'm not quite sure how it benefits the bottom line of Netflix or HBO. Do you think it does?
No, it's all ego.
That's what I mean, thought.
Except for one thing. I mean, once you move to a subscription model, you're trying to give people reason to subscribe, or you're trying to give people reason not to cancel. And if you see a bunch of Emmys or a bunch of Oscars or even to a lesser degree a Golden Globe, it's a come on to make people feel better about subscribing. You're parting with your money to get Netflix, and you're not just getting, you know, wrestling and this woman got kidnapped docuseries. You're also getting, you know, this Oscar winning tier of movies and documentaries and things that they promote very heavily. So,
they've cheapened the brand of an Oscar, certainly in documentaries, if it's the kind of film that can afford a, you know, $500,000 to $1 million budget. I remember when Nat Geo rented out the Hollywood Bowl and had Philip Glass conduct an orchestra as they were screening Jane, the documentary, Brent Morgan's film. And they had swag bags under every single seat of all the people they brought in. I mean, that's insane for a documentary. It corrupts. Again, I'll speak to the thing I know about. It's just plain wrong. How about a spending cap in that one branch? You know, where you say, no, you cannot spend more than screener copies. It's all democratic, and may the best film win. You know,
The other thing, though, this just to get this out on the awards front of it, is it is amazing to me, and I've seen this for a long time. I mean, it goes way back, how oddly starstruck even insanely rich people are.
Oh, God, yes.
And, you know, there was a joke when Lawrence Tisch owned CBS, which was, you know, 30 plus years ago, that that the CBS guys would seat him next to Angela Lansbury at events because he was wowed by sitting next to, you know, the star of Murder, She Wrote, because he watched that show.
Oh, Mom and the Manchurian Candidate. Let's admit, who wouldn't want to sit next to Angela Lansbury? Let's get this on the table right now.
But exactly. Go on. And, you know, and when I see Tim Cook at the Oscars, you know, Apple TV is a rounding error for Apple. And yet, you know, Tim Cook gets to go to the Emmys and go to the Oscars.
Well, it's the one thing money can't buy, because you can't be a movie star or a television star or do what Vince Gilligan does, or some of these, you know, superb showrunners, Aaron Sorkin does, that's kind of magic. That's creative. It's the thing they want the most that they cannot have and never can have. Some of them resent the process. I'm looking at you, David Zaslav, and want to bean count those creatives to death. But some are actually impressed. And, you know, I think that that's maybe what it is. It's the one thing money cannot buy.
Yeah. And I mean, and that's a, you know, you mentioned Vince Gilligan, who did Breaking Bad, and most now he's done a show called Pluribus. And, you know, Pluribus has been a divisive show, and I kind of expected it to be. It's on Apple. But the one thing about Pluribus, which is absolutely bracing, if you watch it, is it feels like someone gave this guy money and said, go do whatever the hell you want. And we're not going to give you notes. We're not going to tell you what to do. There's going to be no adult supervision at all. And what came back is a show that was really distinctive and incredibly weird and original. And that's the one thing, that's the one benefit of these huge players in there, is that, you know, they do all these kind of venal and awful things, but they can also occasionally afford to underwrite something that's really interesting and terrific that wouldn't probably have gotten made otherwise.
But that's Vince Gilligan, though, who's like, he's hit it, you know, as I got this out of Pete Hamill quoting Dizzy Gillespie in a book on Frank Sinatra. The professional's the guy who can do it twice.
Right.
And if you look at Gilligan, this is the guy who made his bones in The X-Files, then Breaking Bad, then absolutely Robin Hood hitting the same arrow with a Better Call Saul. That's a guy who deserves that kind of creative freedom. James Gunn, I have to say, the one thing that he who shall not be named, see, it's better than referring to him as what I'd like to refer to him, then, is bringing in James Gunn to run the DC Comics unit, because that guy is creator-driven in the best sense of that. I mean, he misses sometimes, but he absolutely hears the music. You know, he's a certified genius.
You know, and he does, and he makes stuff that is absolutely his own, you know, where he's dancing to his own drummer and is just doing it solely and strictly for himself. Well, and if anybody else likes it, that's great. And that's kind of the one, but I mean, there are a lot of crazy things associated with this time. The one thing that I would say is a benefit is that you do see people taking flyers on things that would have been incredibly tough sells.
Well, like,
I
what
mean,
others?
In any era.
You're a card-carrying TV critic, and I notice a lot of you have the 1 to 10. You got a lot of sixes there, my friend.
Yeah, there are a lot of sixes.
Yeah, this last list you had were a whole bunch of sixes. What would push your, you know, and again, with a wonderful miracle streaming, this isn't, you can mention things. Yes, we know how great Adolescence was. We know, and those are okay too. What stuff do you think is hitting the mark? What should people go watch? You know, what's good that's coming out that you have a sneak peek at, and what's good that's come out in the last few months that's worth watching in your ever humble opinion?
Well, you know, it's a really mixed bag of stuff. I mean, the one thing I always say is that as a critic, I took a bit of a break when I wasn't a full-time critic for a while, and it was helpful because, you know, at a certain point when you've watched your third or fourth consecutive Netflix six-episode, you know, murder mystery thriller, you start to...
You only got through two episodes of the new Star Trek thing and bailed.
At least
you said it. I mean, you said it in print, you know.
No, I mean, honestly, they sent out six and I watched two and I went, you know, this, I'm good. I've seen enough of this. So, I don't think the second season was nearly as good as the first. I think Severance is an incredibly interesting show. I think Apple has actually had a really good stretch.
Oh, Zach Van Amberg. I worked with him back in the day when he was over at Columbia. And
when I started in this as a beardless boy, his dad was running the local CBS station.
And we all know Bay Area people, Van Amberg.
Yeah.
The case so, of never give an ultimatum you don't want to follow through on when he said, well, if I don't get a raise, I'm leaving. Okay, goodbye. That was that. But his brother ran KABC in Los Angeles, and his brother's son is now head, pretty much creative head with his partner of Apple. And clearly, you know, their success rate, the we don't care, make it good, we trust you, seems they have a high track record of at least they have a lot of duds, but they do get Pluribus on. They've had a couple of really interesting things.
No, I agree. And I think they've done they've done some incredibly interesting shows. I think Pluribus is one that I can't imagine that show running more than two seasons. They ordered two seasons out of the
gate. Hopefully
he'll
stick the landing. One thing about Vince Gilligan, and I think you'd agree, I wait, here's my viewing, is that I wait to see if a new series sticks the landing, which means if it's airing weekly, like say The Pitt did season one, I waited till all of them were out. I don't want to get spoilers. It's always, I have a vague idea. It's Rhea Seehorn and there's some alien thing and it's Vince Gilligan and that's about all I know or want to know on it. But I do know it sticks the landing, so it's worth investing the time. But so many things don't stick the landing, you know?
No, and it's funny now because I actually know people, and this is, by the way, this is a problem for critics and for journalism in one respect. I know people now who don't like to read reviews because they just would rather wait and watch something once it's completed its run.
Well, you go to the I find that just reviews that give away plot points in the headline, which you can't escape, those people should roast in hell for all eternity.
Yeah.
Rosebud's the sled. Surprise, surprise. But I sometimes find if you go to the very end, what I'll do in the report or the trade reviews is the last paragraph is usually good. They usually don't give away spoilers there, and they summarize what's done without giving too much away. But generally, though, if you just go into things cold, that's always the best thing if you can possibly do it.
Maybe. But I will say the thing that drives me nuts, and this is as someone who's been forced to do this kind of thing, is that, you know, they drop, say, the 2-hour finale of Stranger Things, which I actually enjoyed a lot, more than I enjoyed the show mostly running up to it. But, and then literally there are 200 think pieces about it posting 2 hours and 15 minutes after it premiered.
And it's really tough if you're on the internet. Now, I binged the whole series of Stranger Things, and I somehow managed to avoid it all. And I'm not going to give spoilers on the radio. First off, I actually enjoyed it. It got there was a lot of, you know, the usual self-indulgent, and yeah, I think Linda Hamilton was wasted and whatever happened to her. But I liked, and I don't think I'm giving too much away, I liked 40 minutes at the end where it's just the characters sitting around talking. I thought that was great. No problem with that. I wanted to hang out with those people longer. And if it was self-indulgent, fine. It didn't bother me in the slightest. I was invested after, five seasons in those people. And I thought they really did stick the landing in an emotional sense.
Well, the one thing now is that, and this gets back to the click part of it, is that there is this
clicktatorship, remember?
Yeah, the clicktatorship. This emphasis on traffic, and that you have to have something, you know, everything. Look, I'm a big fan of writing about things, and I'm a really big fan of connecting them to larger issues and larger industry trends. Or larger cultural trends.
You can make a living doing that, you know?
You could try. It's harder these days. But occasionally it feels so labored. I mean, there's a show on HBO Max called Heated Rivalry, which is about a couple of hockey players who start a
hunky
kind
hockey
of torrid gay relationship. And it's become a huge sensation. And, you know, it's an interesting, well-done show with two hot guys rolling around together. And yet, I literally, the number of hot takes I've seen, I saw one today, I think it was The Atlantic, which was sort of Heated Rivalry is significant because it connects it deals with sexuality in a way that nothing else does. And I was like, no, it doesn't. I mean, I've seen Maybe I've seen too much, but I've seen plenty of sexuality. It's
well,
not
HBO.
Bad.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, remember Skinamax? We can go back to the original days.
Yeah,
of HBO.
So it's, you know, it's more serious and it's well done, but it's there really is this pressure and just to give you an idea of how the sausage gets made, you know, is people will come and say, I mean, I remember Ed previously, you know, how can we represent on this? Because this show is getting a lot of traffic. And I my answer used to always be, there's probably something interesting to say about it if you give me 10 minutes to think of something that isn't what everybody else is saying about it. You know, at least let's try to look at it in a slightly different way or to be slightly smart about it. But what that ends up being for a lot of people in a lot of places is you just dramatically overreach. Well, you know, you see a lot of things written about shows and movies that this is the best thing or the worst thing or unprecedented, or and things are seldom unprecedented and they're seldom the best and they're seldom the worst. If you've seen a lot of movies and TV shows, you've almost always seen something worse and almost always seen something better.
And, you know, as my career was started out in its heyday of
except
popularity.
Your stuff.
Well, yes, which worked overtime to plumb the depths of depravity. You know, what can I say?
There's an art to that as well.
Well, I like to say, you know, I went on to do interesting things, but people were saying, yeah, you did Grizzly Man. I go, yeah, but, you know, busted on the job, which the centerpiece of the show was a disgruntled worker relieving himself in his boss's coffee pot, was a top 10 show in sweeps on Fox back when that meant something. That's a lot harder to do than an art film with Werner Herzog pontificating about bears. You know, it's like, that's a real achievement. I have no qualms it'll follow me when the Nuremberg media trials convene. I'm sure I'm going to be up there in the dock. But
I will say, and this is as a nod, because I'm not giving David Zaslav credit for this, but that the it's AMC, it's not Discovery. My absolute palate cleanser when I'm watching stuff is the Planet Earth series on BBC America.
Oh, David Attenborough,
And on the weekends, they run those documentaries, they just stack them. And, you know, it's kind of a running joke if I'm watching something that I'll flip over and just see, you know, is the bear going to catch the seal? And that's,
well, it's mesmerizing.
I can kill 15 minutes any time of the day watching to see if the polar bear is going to catch the seal.
Well, it's like a Ken Burns. You know, we have, you know, I've spoken offline a fair amount about Ken Burns. Speaking of that, PBS, what do you think? You know, we're getting backslide to the political. Is PBS done for? Is the collapse of CBS now going to help, say, Frontline, might help the CBS the PBS NewsHour by filling that void of just reflecting reality, which is something that the senile Satan and his minions cannot abide, is that, no, our reality, don't not believe what you just saw in the Renee Good video. That didn't happen. This is what we say happened. Get in line. Do you see PBS benefiting or whatever's left of PBS? Can they survive what's just happened to them?
I mean, it's tough. It's a tough thing to weigh from Los Angeles because major market, I think PBS stations are going to be okay. They have resources and they can throw stuff out there and they can, you know, they can find ways to kind of help support themselves. The destruction of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and it really was just on venal, vindictive grounds.
Well, that's it. Every decision this administration does is venal, vindictive, or incoherent, or a combination of all three.
What that is going to do, and I think, and I don't know if it's repairable because we'll see where we are in a couple of years, is it's going to destroy a lot of stations in smaller markets that were sort of lifelines. You know, that not, I would venture, not a ton of people watched, but the people who watched them were really connected to them. And that's just it's a kind of tragic. I mean, they may have gone that way eventually. You know, it may have been that PBS didn't have a in an age of so much plenty and abundance and streaming and all everything else, they may not have had a really long future, but it's sort of like somebody who was in the hospital and they went in and put a pillow over its face.
And the thing was, we could agree on PBS. You know, there were certain brands that stood for something. 60 Minutes, which we've mentioned. HBO was certainly a trademark of quality. PBS had a certain imprint here. David Attenborough in Planet Earth. You know, there were certain things that we...
And look, Frontline is still... I still watch... Frontline documentaries and see, you know, even if it's a topic I'm somewhat familiar with, the dives they take into it are really, can be really illuminating.
And
it's often on stuff that other people, that isn't commercial enough for other people to want to weigh in on it.
Well, the new clicktatorship, I think, is what can Americans agree on besides Willie Nelson and Dolly Parton? I think that's it, by the way. I don't think there's anything else that Americans can agree on now is an abiding love and respect for Willie and Dolly. And as those brands are being torpedoed, as the clicktatorship is moving, where as critics are fragmenting, you know, a musician friend of mine talking about internet critics said, they're worse than critics. They're amateur critics. And, you know, everyone has an opinion and everyone has a bully pulpit to express it. So it's strap, you know, hang on tight, you know. But an optimistic note, I always like to end on optimistic things, is, you know, you found an outlet. Tell listeners a little bit about Status and where they can find it, because it is – I think it's great. I'm the world's cheapest human being when it comes to online content or any content whatsoever. I subscribed. When you were hired, then I said, I guess I can't cancel now. I'm in for a year. but I think it's great. And how can people find it? And give us a little.
It's at status.news is the site. And it was founded by a guy named Oliver Darcy, who had been at CNN and been a media reporter there and doing a newsletter, and left and started his own. And then John Passantino, another CNN alum, came over and joined him. And they were running it on their own, putting out four or five newsletters a week. And a few months ago, they brought me and a woman named Natalie Korich in. And so we're now a seven-day-a-week newsletter. Mine is a little bit different. It covers media primarily, a lot of what's going on in the news industry. Mine is a little bit different because I'm based on the West Coast, so the focus is more on Hollywood, and then I work in a section where I review kind of what's coming out that week. So there's kind of a guide to what you can watch that
a lot
weekend.
Of sixes out of ten this week, I might point out.
Yeah, and it was, this week was a particularly fertile week. There was just a lot of stuff that I thought was worth watching. So you know, things like The Rip with Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, and the Star Trek series Starfleet Academy, which I said was a CW drama, RIP. So it's been interesting, and, you know, and it's a trial and error process, because I think you have to, the one thing you have to do now is be responsive to what people want to see. I don't think you pander to them, but I think you can have a little bit more of a dialogue with the people that are listening to you and the people that are reading you, and just kind of get a sense of what they're responding to. And, you know, maybe we do a little more of that and a little less of this.
Yeah. I mean, it's tricky because, you know, old school journalists are not used to being questioned by the riffraff reading them. You know, they're not that they aren't, and the good ones are, but this idea of a democratic filter where you can talk back. I find, frankly, the Washington Post, the AI distillation of their comments on their idiot editorials are the best, because it takes 1,500 rants from readers and distills it into very potent, distillation. It's the only good use of AI that I've found. And also I check the New York Times. It's hard to read their editorials, but the reader comments and the reader's choice comments are often very illuminating and make you feel a little better. We're not completely lost as a nation and a culture, if people can respond and sort of instinctually kind of tack towards morality and justice and truth. Sound like an old Superman introduction here, but that's what we're dealing with. Well, believe it or not, it's time for our boot heels to be wandering. It is the top of the hour. Brian Lowry, I'm not going to put you on the spot, but would love to have you back. We feel like we just started a conversation that can go on quite a bit, and there's so much to talk about as you are at the epicenter of all things political and cultural right now.
Well, now that I know how to sign in, you know where to find me.